Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony is still recuperating, so Sean McNally, which is the hardcore and the punk and all the metal, he's doing a wonderful job, and he's going to be with me, and he's taking this over right now with the Dogmatics. Welcome.
Yay!
I love the way you say that.
We've got three Dogmatics in the house today, and I'm glad they could all make the time. I know it's not easy. We're all still working and have lives outside of music, of course, but I do want to welcome Jerry Lehane, Tommy Long, and Peter O'Halloran, three of the main cogs, of course. Unfortunately, Jimmy's busy right now, and James is one of the members of the band. We can talk about him later on, but this is really kind of about the old days of the channel and the Boston scene of the 80s and whatnot. So welcome to the show, guys. Really appreciate you guys joining us, first of all.
Yep. Thank you, John. Absolutely.
So here's the deal. I know you guys formed in 81. I kind of see the Dogmatics, as I'm sure many people do, as kind of having at least two major phases, right? The first phase was the early years as things got going, say the first 5 or 6 years or so. Of course, tragedy followed that. We can talk about that a little bit later on. And then kind of the second phase is like this rebirth or this reinterest or, you know, reignition, whatever you want to call it. But it's pretty outstanding and pretty amazing to see from the outside of kind of how you guys have kind of got back into the forefront of the Boston music scene, you know, decades after you guys essentially stopped. So let's go back to the very beginning, though. So, again, I know you guys have formed in 1981. You guys had a history of calling a school together and whatnot. Why don't I don't know, Jerry, you want to take over that? Just the genesis of the band, how the band, the Dogmatics, first came together, friends of other bands at that time, and then maybe we can go from there.
Well, I was living in Weymouth at the time. I was working at the Copley Plaza Hotel downtown Boston. So I'd commute every day. Paul O'Halloran, Peter's twin brother, moved up to Boston to Thayer Street, right, Pete?
Yeah, with him and TK got the loft.
Yeah, and that was at 8 Thayer Street, the original loft, which is smaller than the second loft we moved to on Thayer Street. And Paul had already been playing a bit. He was in a band called the Savage Beasties, and he was, you know, he actually had some time out there where I was more of a, like, you know, I could play the guitar and was more of a fan and would go to shows and watch shows, you know, and I think Paul actually brought me to my first rock show at the Rat, where I saw the band Boys Life and Shrapnel. I kind of was blown away by the whole thing because I had never seen anything like that before, like young kids playing their own songs. And then Paul's like, he goes, why don't you move into the loft and I'll get Peter to move in and we'll start a band. And literally that's what it was. And I moved out of my mother's house in Weymouth and moved up there for $75 a month.
Not today.
The funny thing about it, so when you went to this loft at 8th Thayer Street, you had to walk up a lot of stairs to get to the top floor. We were on the top floor at that time.
Yeah.
But the big thing about it, we had these we also had stairs that went to the roof of the, and you could look out and see the Prudential Building. That's how close we were to downtown. And the place was completely empty. There were no walls, anything. And you remember what we did, Peter, to build walls? What did we do?
Yeah, we built walls.
No. No? You remember what we did? We took rugs. And we hung them.
Oh, at first, yeah. Right.
Yeah. We hung rugs to separate our rooms.
Sure.
And that's where in our bedrooms were like separated by rugs. And then we had like a practice space right in the open at the beginning before we eventually did build walls and whatnot. But everything was like wide open. So basically when Peter was like having sex with some chick, I could see it. And they were usually heavy girls too, I must say.
Man. Man, I was very uninhibited. Yeah, there might be a grain of truth to what he's saying, but yeah, you know.
I love it.
But, for sure. I know that's happened.
But honestly, that's what we did. We moved in there. It was really inexpensive, $75 a month. We didn't have to pay for electricity, all that stuff. Our good friend TK kind of arranged everything. TK at the time was in a band called Spearhead Go, right, Pete?
Well, they were forming at the same time as we were forming.
Yeah.
You know, I was in a band with a couple of the members that formed his band. You know how those things work. You know?
Right. Yeah.
And then, but you guys went to school even before that, right?
What's that? Yes.
You guys went to school, met each other before that, before the whole loft thing.
Yes.
Oh, sure. I've known Jerry since the first grade, which is what, you're 6 years old?
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I walked into class, you know, like I remember the first day, and there's two kids with, you know, they had eyeglasses on and like patches. I think Paul had a patch over his eye on top of the glasses, right? Yeah. You know, back then, that's how they treated the lazy eye. They'd put a patch on one side to make the other eye strong.
Yeah.
But you didn't even get pirate credibility back then either.
That's true.
A little weirdo, you know.
Was it was the color of the patch. I don't know whether you go, it was the black one or the cream one. I think it was.
It was supposed to be like skin color, I guess.
Yeah, they were like skin color.
That's exactly.
A Band-Aid.
I think because we were kind of the same ilk, we were wise asses, we were kind of drawn to together, you know?
Yeah.
Well, Catholic school helped you bring that out of you for sure, right? So.
I think
Tommy cut off the call. Can you have Tommy rejoin? Is that possible?
Is off?
You can have him dial him back in so we don't lose him.
Yeah, it was off there. Okay.
I think he got dropped by mistake. Yeah, is there any way we can get him back on?
Yeah, we're just trying.
Just add Tommy back to the call.
617.
Are you working on him, Miss Honey?
For a second to try and patch Tommy back in. So you guys school together. The music thing kind of became of interest to you. You had a buddy who was a little bit older, was a cool kid and could play music, and you had this place downtown and at Thayer Street, which of course back then was a completely different world than it is today. But so you guys started at 8.
Hey, this is Tom.
Tom, we got you now. We got you back.
I know, it's kind of a blur. We got the upgrade.
Tommy is here.
Perfect.
Bobby Long, TL.
Hi, guys. Hi.
I didn't miss too much.
There you go. We had a dropout. That was what it was.
Sorry about that.
All right, perfect. So, yeah, we're just going back to kind of the early days, the genesis of the band, Tommy. And then so Jerry's giving us with Peter a little walk through the whole Thayer Street days, and then kind of that's kind of where we're at like right now. So, So Peter, you were already playing in bands. You said, what other bands you were playing in? Just kind of other local bands at that point?
I played with this drummer, this guy I knew called Joey Olson from Dorchester, and me and this other guy, Barry Hall, who did our graphic arts on our record. We're in a band called Joey O and the Strategos. And we got up an 8-song set and then broke up. Never played anywhere.
And then I know in the very beginning, Danny Shannon was the first drummer, right? But he had another career besides music, right? And then Tommy came in on board pretty much shortly thereafter, yes?
Yeah, he left to go to college and become a commercial fisherman.
He still does today, I think, right? He's still fishing?
He is.
Yep.
He
owns that's awesome.
Charlie out of Marshfield.
Amazing.
He has a fish shop called the Snug, right?
Yeah, Snug Harbor down in Duck Creek.
Snug Harbor, yeah, it's great, yeah. We see him occasionally. He shows up to the shows.
That's great.
You know?
That's great. We've been in contact over the years. That's pretty awesome. So tell me the first, you guys, because you're messing around in the loft, kind of getting, you know, figuring out what you're going to do, what you're going to play, what kind of music you're going to do. And I think you guys had your first quote unquote show was actually in the loft, I think, right?
It was. And at that time, you know, so we didn't have a lot of originals. So we were doing covers. And Paul had a bunch that he liked. Pete was, you know, influenced by Eddie Cochran, Buddy Holly. And so we were doing some of that stuff along with like the Ramones we'd throw in, which was kind of the three chord rock that we kind of specialized in. And we did play our first show at the Loft, but it wasn't under the Dogmatics. Do you remember the name of the band, Pete?
Yeah, it was called the Gutter Snipes.
Yeah.
Gutter Snipes, what a great name. What a good trivia question that is.
Yeah.
I love it.
I was one thing, because we didn't have a name, so I think I just thought of that song.
Did you get it out of a Class song?
Well, the truth is only known by the fill in the blank.
Yep, Gutter Snipes. Yeah.
But it's also a word that was in my vocabulary anyway.
He got it from Charles Dickens, man.
Yeah, Jack. Yeah. Our Dickensian roots.
Another one.
So who's living at the Loft in this time frame? Like when you had that first Gutter Snipes gig?
Me, Peter, Paul, and TK.
Cool. Yes. Gotcha. And then down the road, a couple of years, you said you moved to a bigger space on Thayer Street, number 16. And
right.
By that point, as the band, you've been your name's out there, you're established, you're actually playing gigs, I'm assuming, at that point, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So TK, band Spearhead Go, had folded, and his next band, was his next band Last Stand, Peter?
Yeah, I believe so.
It wasn't Buzz in the Gang, right? That was something different, I'm thinking of, right?
Yeah, that's something different.
That was later on,
yeah. So, yeah, we moved from 1,500 square feet, top floor, access to the roof, which was cool, to a 3,000 square foot spot, same situation, no walls, although there was some offices in there, and I think Pete pretty much got the best room right away, right?
I think it was, it used to be a dress factory and it was the boss's office. And I was like,
oh.
Yeah, he got the boss's office.
I don't know how I lucked out, you know.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. And so we built a practice space in that loft, right in the middle. And that kind of forced you to practice more. However, you know, you're living there too, so you didn't have a night off because TK had a band, so there was someone playing almost every night.
Right.
So it was we got a bunch of mattresses just big enough to fit a set of drums and a bunch of amps and a bunch of people.
It was very no frills. Yeah, if you ever
later on became like really a real go-to party spot for a lot of for a long time there, which we can talk about a little bit later on. So when does Tommy come into the play? When does Tommy join the band?
Right around this time, I believe. No, I'm sorry. Tommy was in the original Loft. Because I remember Tommy and I practicing, just me and him. When I wrote the song Pussy Whipped, it was me and him in the space that was against the Thayer Street. And we had it was like a hot summer day like today. We had the window open. It was blowing in. I don't know if you remember that song. It's a long time ago. I would say that was 1982. I think that Dan only played in the band 1 year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And Tommy, you want that? You were like, how old were you? 17 or 18?
17, I guess. Yeah.
17 years old, weighed 90 pounds. Baby, don't get wet.
So you're paying $75 a month for 8 there. How much did the rent go up to for your double the size at 16 there?
Not much. Maybe 100 apiece.
Yeah, incredible.
125. TK worked all that out with the.
Was it like $100 a month or something like that?
Yeah. Amazing.
But, you know, again, we kind of figured out ways to supplement that money by having parties after hours and buy some kegs, have some bands play, people show up, give you whatever they have, and it could pay for the rent sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. It was an amazing time for sure.
Exactly.
So you guys are now essentially the unit, the four of you guys, and so you do start gigging out, right? I think the first show was at Canton's, is that correct? First official show?
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
It was a Tuesday night with a band called Nick's Kitchen, spelled N-I-X.
Gotcha.
And we literally kind of followed like what TK was already playing out in Spearhead Go. And he'd be like, all right, all you have to do is just go down, see the woman Marlo behind the bar, give her a cassette. We made like a cassette recording of us playing in the practice space, gave it to her. And then she's like, yeah, you guys want to play next Tuesday? And literally, you know, nowadays, you know, Tuesday night would suck. Back then, we were delighted to even get a show.
Yeah.
Right. And also back then, you could play like every night of the week, essentially, without really any club or place or any venues getting pissed off about it. You could play all over the place.
And we would do that often, yeah.
Yeah. So those early days, you guys pretty quickly got things going, played out quite a bit. I know you guys released a single and then not too long after, a couple of albums on Homestead. So how did, give us like the, I guess, the career path from your first show, Cantones, to be a single out pretty, not too long after that, I believe. How long was that about?
I would say it was pretty quickly, you know, like, again, someone else already did the template for us. Like, TK, the Del Fuegos were practicing upstairs from us. And because they were playing out already and then they would record, we're like, okay, well, we got to record. So, you know, we write the songs and then we're like, okay, what can we afford? So, you know, back then it was 8-track recording. And we went to Radio Beat, which was
turns out you really don't need much more than that, huh?
True. And so we recorded at Radio Beat with Lou Giordano and Mick Miller was the assistant.
Yes.
Wow. You have a good memory, bro. That's awesome.
That's
great. That was a pretty. So, you know, again, this is the channel. It's about the channel of podcasting the most. Around the same time, you guys did get your first show at the channel. Even in the early days, you were.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out how quickly it took to get to the channel, because the first time we had you playing the channel was September of '82. So this is, again, the pretty early stage of the band. So you must have been just playing out locally at the typical places back then, which I'm going to assume are like Cantones, Jumpin' Jack Flash, The Rat, The Underground. I mean, any of the play, you know, those kind of places, smaller places around town. But pretty quickly, you're at the channel in '82.
Well, Pete, you know why we were at the channel. Do you remember?
Yeah, it was the NU Music Review, NU.
There you go. New Music Night. Yep.
Oh, but no, but then remember we did the SMAP thing, the Somerville Media Action Project, and they had like a fundraiser at the channel.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was at the channel. Yeah.
That was at the channel.
That was actually your fourth show there, which is kind of pretty quick order. You guys played in September
82.
It was a Tuesday night, New Music Night, which was a popular. The main way to get the gig at that time was all the new bands playing and play and try and bring their friends out to see if they were a draw for a weekend show. And then a month later, the first. I was like, holy crap, what a lineup! You guys played there in October.
October 10th.
Miami, the Cosmetics, Outlet, Gangrene. Prime Movers,
yep. I remember that.
Dogmatic. What a show, you know?
But that was Joyce Linehan. That was,
all
she
ages.
Started that magazine. Yeah. And she
was on ages.
That
yep.
show. We were the opener, I believe, for that show. We were the opener, yeah.
You were the headliner.
What a lineup of Boston music back in that time. What a great lineup.
You were the headliner on September 7th, 82. You were the headliner. And then Tiger Rose, and then... June the Substance, and then October 10th with Lou Miami, the Klondike, the Outlets, Gangrene, Prime Movers, and you guys, and it's all ages. And then the December 23rd with James Cotton.
Yeah.
The Dog. And then the Dogmatics.
That was right around Christmas. Yeah, she had that hit song, Johnny, Are You Queer Boy, on the radio at the time.
Wow.
That's right. That's it was a good, Christmas week.
We changed that to PETA, Are You Queer Boy?
Wow. Are You Queer Boy instead of Choir Boy?
That just means odd. We just meant he was an odd boy.
Yeah.
So didn't we also play that same time we played, sometimes you do double gigs. I'm thinking that the Josie Cotton time, we we went across town later that night and played somewhere else. So
yeah, I think you're right.
You could have been.
Might have surprised it all back.
Is that right or not? I don't know. Couldn't have been that.
It could be doing.
I don't know, like when Chet started or when Jumpin' Jack Flash, but I think that was later down the line.
Yeah,
maybe a little bit after that. Yeah.
And then
I used to have a channel gate shift. I wouldn't be surprised if I played two shows in the same night across town. Wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah.
Do you know how many times that we? Sean, do you have an idea of how many times we actually played at the channel?
15.
Yeah.
15 Dogmatic shows.
15.
Wow.
And there were also, and later on, you were obviously in the Matt Weaves. The Matt Weaves played there 10 times. That was a lot when I was expecting to see.
Wow. Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, 15 times the channel. Yeah. So you guys did those first two shows, 82, 83, The Dark, Dogmatic, Stranglehold, Mission Impossible. That was in June that year. It is 83 now. With the Pajama Slave Dancer. This is the one we talked about, the Benefit for Somerville Media Action Project. That was another big show at some of the bigger local bands in the area. And you guys were on that bill.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was fun. One thing that I can remember, though, is the type of amp I used to play the first time I played at the channel. And because I really didn't know any better. I had a Sun 250-watt head, transistor head.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
In an acoustic cabinet with 6 12-inches. It was like the bottom half of a refrigerator.
We dragged that thing around, yeah.
Man, like, the sound man looking at me like, what are you doing, kid? I'm like, I don't know. It's my amp. Who cares?
I think.
But I kind of got tired of dragging that around after the first year or so.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
I think it's good.
So we're going to jump up to 84, Shockability, Dogmatics, and Relentless. This is in April 84. You're playing around town quite a bit. You came back in November that year. This is a big show. Hoodoo Goos, Long Riders, and Dogmatics. That must have been an awesome one.
Yeah, that was a great show.
Long Riders were really good.
Absolutely. Yeah, Long Riders were good guys.
With YouTube after that. Yeah, they were popular.
Yeah, they
another big show later than early 85. Another three big local bands, the Blackjacks, Dogmatics, and Last Stand. Another really strong build of that era.
Yeah,
In March, yeah.
And 85 again, we're still. But you did this. Is what I want to ask you guys about. I have an IRS listening party for the new REM record, and you guys played that event. Do you have any memories of that one?
No recollection whatsoever.
I'm just telling you that either. I was trying to figure this out because it says IRS, which back then they would do these little, you know, record listening parties. They'd have a band play, and then they would play the new REM record or whatever band they were promoting. But yeah, I had this down there for some reason. You guys playing, but I don't know. I don't remember that.
And August 17th. It was Del Fuego's and Dogmatics and Chainlink Fence. That's a good, nice interview.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That's a good one.
That was the first. Actually, that was actually your first weekend, not counting the Sunday All Ages show. That was actually your first weekend playing the channel. So what a great gig to be on with the Del Fuego's.
Yeah, really.
they had just come back from California and kind of had that hit radio. The place was jam packed, and we went on right before them, which was. You know, it's just great because I don't. How many people did that club hold? It was it held a lot.
Yeah, legally it was either 1,500 or 1,700, and I know we went over that occasionally. So I mean, there was no better place to play as far as on a big bill, especially where the place is jammed. I mean, the professional sound system, the stage. I mean, everything was just like really set up to make you guys look like rock stars, which is one of the big reasons we missed that place.
Yeah, they paid us the peanuts too to play.
typical. You usually get tickets to give out, get a dollar back for these tickets.
Oh, so Sean,
the guys pretty much a couple cases of beer. You guys were sat happy back then, right? So
right. But Sean, one of the things that you know, I'm sure you always knew that. So I remember at the very beginning, we knew that you know. Okay, here's your tickets. Give these out to your friends. Have them come to the show, and then you guys count the tickets. Wow, this band did 100 or whatever. Right. We used to always distract the sound man and just stuff that box with all the tickets that we had. All the time. And we're like, and then you know, hey, you guys want to play here? You did fantastic. You had like 2. I'm like, wow.
Well, it worked. It worked.
It worked.
And then not even a month after that Del Fuego's gig, you guys were then the benefit. You guys were going to do a benefit. So it was a Bands of Boston for the Children of Ethiopia. Remember this one was Red Rockers, Dogmatics, Willie Alexander, Scruffy the Cat, Rods and Cones, Three Colors, Blackjacks, Dub 7, The Turbines, The Neighborhoods, K Capture the Flag. I mean, holy crap, what a lineup.
Yeah, it's a lineup.
Yeah, funny. I know all those
bigger bands that era. Then not even a month later, you're back on a Friday night with the Liars, another band you guys are really close with and really admired. I know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And don't you remember, you have to remove the drums, you know. There were so many drums in nights like that. It was unbelievable.
You know what we used to call the channel, the Rock and Roll Supermarket?
Yeah, well, that's why it was lined up. That's why all the equipment was lined up with four or five bands, and you peeled them off, and you had, from Orange to Marshall to this one to that one, and all of a sudden there would be guys with cabinets with nothing in them, just Marshall cabinets, and six cabinets in a row, and only one with one piece set of speakers. And we're like, yeah, really? We never did.
They wanted to look cool,
We had them full, and we always cranked them up to max and stuff.
Oh God!
In the same time frame, this is the '86 or into now. So you played a couple more times. Once at Blockyard, another time. Ice Nine and Bastille Starfires. It was a Monday night. I guess it was a benefit. This was mid 86.
Yeah, big benefit.
And then, you know, of course, tragedy unfortunately strikes the band with Paul. For those who knew or didn't know at the time, you know, Paul and Peter, of course, were twins. Yeah. Maybe without getting to the too dark stuff here, Peter, tell us, about your brother, first of all, about Paul, and then, of course, with the accident and how it really, completely floored everybody around here, not just you guys.
Yeah, it's, all these years later talking about it, it's still pretty rough, you know, for me.
Sure.
If you watch our documentary, I kind of get into it a little bit, and it's just like, if you're a twin, you don't think anything else usually. Like, you got somebody who's like you, and, you know, we kind of had our own, language of sorts growing up and, really close and probably considered kind of weird, you know, but, that's just the way it is when you're a twin. And, it was unforeseen, but, you know, we did a lot of stupid shit back then, riding around on crappy motorcycles and, you know, just, you know, typical stuff you do in your 20s. And, so when it happened, it was devastating to all of us. And, the only real saving grace is having legions of good friends and a giant family to help soak up the sting of it, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
But only
that's pretty hard to recover from that.
Life, it still sucks, you know?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh,
of course.
It'll keep doing that
forever. And it's hard to put it in perspective in words, but it's just he was a real live wire. Like we all were like this, you know, the sum of our parts and there was always something going on, always something fun and, you know, getting the most out of life. Even as if we knew there's not much around the corner, you know?
Right. Well, you know, at that time, you know, you're talking, you're all young still. Everybody's always, back in Boston in the 80s was, there were shows every night. There were parties at lofts every night. There was, you know, everybody thought you'd think you're invincible. You know, you just do dumb things, and you know, unfortunately, occasionally there's a real tragedy that occurs, and that was certainly one. And I know that the town really, really united, and I know the Rat especially, the couple of big benefit shows to help raise some funds, and that must have been, the outpouring was huge. I mean, it must have been quite touching to you guys, realizing the kind of effect that you had around the town, at least, then it wasn't for naught with, the terrible accident with Paul, but it brought the scene together even closer at that point, I would say. Is there anything positive that came out of it?
And one thing it really did is I think it really blew my parents away to see
that. Oh, sure.
It was such a big community thing, and one time we played live on WERS, and it was, live on the college radio. And my parents heard, my father heard. He goes, he says to me and my brother, he goes, you guys got a lot of gall. and I'm like, thanks, Dad. I'll take that as a compliment.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Oh, man. So, yeah, we can move on. So that point, the band essentially, for all intents and purposes, pretty much ended there. And I would say that's kind of the end of the whole phase one thing. I mean, you guys even buried his bass with him, right?
That's right. It happened because it was a conversation of, like, I also had a crack up on my motorcycle, like, I don't know, a year before that, 2 years, I don't know what. And I was like, holy shit, that was close. I go, hey, if anything ever happens to me, make sure you bury me with my guitar. Like, ha ha, you know. Because you don't think that's going to happen. He goes, okay, same goes for me, ha ha, you know. And
yeah, for sure. Wow.
Oh, that's what we did.
Incredible. And so essentially, again, that was kind of the end of the back. Because they go, what do you do? I think everybody's just like stunned and shocked. And what do you do? How do we go forward? And without Paul, but of course, you guys remain friends over the years to this day. Occasionally, there were requests for you guys to do some benefit shows and whatnot, which you guys almost always said yes to. And then the one thing that was great about the getting together with these benefits was, you know, Peter's and Paul's family, there's another O'Halloran to step in and play bass if needed. And that happened many times with either Jimmy or Johnny coming in to help out, correct?
Correct.
And to this day now, of course, Jimmy's been pretty much the straight bass player for quite a while now. So, so he helped, you know, and Jimmy helped fill on bass, kind of became full-time. And then to get to like I don't want to completely skip all the first part of the phase one, because you had a couple of records out locally on Homestead. You had a song on the radio, Give Me the Shakes. Real quickly, what was that Give Me the Shakes about? What was, give me the genesis of that song.
Well, although Peter says it's about my dislike for cockroaches, it's not true.
Turns out he really likes them, I guess.
You know, it's just all of it, you know. So I was influenced probably by the Liars. I really liked that sound, that early 60s sort of sound, and that's kind of almost a, not a tribute to them, but that sort of sound. And it's a girl, you know, just writing about a girl. Yes, one track mind, exactly. And so that's all, just that certain sound. And if, you know, if you've listened to our records, you can see we're all over the map kind of with our sound or our, you know, influences. And
that
is a 60s pop song, you know. That's how I look at it. And you know, everyone has different meanings for every song. You can find something different if you listen in your own way.
Yeah,
sure. So, sure,
whatever.
And get into a little bit later on, so a couple quotes here I want to read, because I think these are really spot on as far as other people have written about the Dogmatics and what they were like. A.J. Wattel, most of you guys, I'm sure, know. He was a local guy, writes for the Music Museum of New England. He had a quick little summary of saying, the bands Chuck Berry meets New York Dolls, Nick Lowe meets Eddie Cochran, and Stiff Little Fingers meet the Clash sound. And that's pretty spot on. I think it's pretty spot on for sure.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I can't complain about that one. And then the other one, too, you guys have a documentary out, which we're going to mention for sure. It's excellent. And I think anybody remotely tied to the Boston scene, the Dogmatics, or the whole scene in general from the 80s, to really do a favor and watch it. Rudy Chow's done an incredible job. It's called Documentary. It's a documentary about the Dogmatics, of course, and cleverly it's called The Dogmatics, a Dogumentary. They were Boston's house band. And that's another really true statement into that era. But one of the good quotes about this, the Dogmatics were no different than any other talentless, self-deprecating, beer-swilling, girl-chasing, lunkheads with guitars. They were young, young, selfless, and affable. Playing was the only thing that mattered. Money, of course, was unexpectedly welcomed, but catching a girl's eye, a free round of drinks, or simply completing a song in unison were their rewards. That's awesome. That's a great way. I know that, I think, Jerry, you might have contributed to that, but also Kate Roper, a friend of the band from way back, and also Jeeves.
Yeah, he's my cousin.
Credit with writing that out. That's a tremendous way to, you know, say what the band was all about. Very, very head, you know, spot on, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
So let's
focus some of the memories you guys have of the channel. I know you guys, you know, also attended shows there, right? So let's talk about, maybe we'll start with you, Tommy, because I haven't heard too much from you, buddy. Give me some of your memories of attending shows, and not as a performer so much, but either to go see shows or whether they were friends or national acts and whatnot, and what your memories of that would be.
Oh, yeah.
the Sundays were good. I don't know when those Sundays started, but I seem to remember going there when, I guess I was it 18, the legal age to go to places?
Yes. You know, that's a good point. In the early 80s, that's exactly what it was, which really helped get the people out to see bands at night. No question about it.
Yep.
Okay, so there were just a few where I had to either get in there on the sly, and then I turned 18, and then I tried to go there as much as I could because it was just such a great place. There was always somebody there. You could always find people, your friends. The acts were great. There were like a million places to get away. Like you could go so far back in the club. You could, have a 5-minute conversation if you needed to, and then go back up to the front and see the madness or whatever it was. Right. In fact, I think I saw maybe I saw Madness there. If they played there, I saw them.
Yeah, they did. They did. That was one of their first shows.
Yeah. So I was at that, and all those like Brit pop type bands we used to go to, like I said, the Jam. Although I did get ejected from the Jam, I don't know why. I think probably because I didn't pay.
I got out back.
I just sat by those double doors right behind the stage, on the broken down pier, and just listened. So that was good. That happened a few times.
That's Sean's crew doing that.
We try to keep people in one piece for sure.
Absolutely. It wasn't the bouncers never opened the door with my head like they did at many other places.
You did mention before, it's on the Jam. You said Charlie Watts was a great show you went to there. Shrapnel and the Bad Brains, of course, one of the best bands of all time.
Charlie Watts with Jack Bruce was playing bass. Wow.
Yeah.
Shrapnel's one of the first shows I saw. I don't know what that was, but I think that's one of the first shows I saw.
Oh.
Yeah, that's probably like 81, 2, 3, early part of the 80s for sure. And that one, look it up.
I just loved the place. It was super comfortable, and
The supermarket.
The drinks were stiff too.
And you remember you also had that area where there was like pinball machines and
In
the middle,
the very back of the club. Yep.
And then you had like a drop down like dance floor thing with that had different colors coming out of the floor.
Well, there was.
I remember that.
It was the stage, so there were two dressing rooms, right? So the one dressing room was by the one like off stage, right? Like way in the corner. You had to walk across like there was a fenced in little area there, like a dance floor. There was used to have a big disco ball up there, and there would a different floor. That was the big one to like stage right off there. But there was a big pit right in front of the stage, of course. All the kids do the slam dance, and you could see from everywhere. One thing about the Channel was great; you could literally see from anywhere. So the people in the very front. We're in the pit, essentially, and then so the people in the back could stand and see, no problem, see the band. Plus, you have, like, a 5-foot stage, and, it was really, like you said, Tommy, there's a lot of places you could just hang on the back, have a drink, you could still see the show, or go have, get away for a minute, go smoke a butt out back, and then go see, play a couple of video games or whatever. It was big enough where you could do that and have a little chat on the side before the next band came on or whatever, walk around, get a drink, see the flyers on the wall for upcoming shows, you could get a hot dog or a popcorn at the merchandise booth there, the food stand, so... it was great in a lot of reasons. Exactly. That was one of them.
Yeah. Sight lines, just places to hang out. It was once you were in, you were like, you're in there.
Right.
You go in when it's
like, you mentioned, Jerry Lee Lewis, one of the shows you remember from the Channel from going as a fan, right?
Yeah. I particularly remember that in, James Burton, who was Ricky Nelson's guitar player in the 60s. And, also, this side guy with Paisley Kelly, he's backing up Jerry Lee. That was great because that was right up my alley.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if we went to that together.
I was at that show too,
Yeah. And my wife remember seeing James Brown, something
else. Now, correct me if I'm Jerry Lee Lewis show, correct me if I'm wrong, did Did Jerry Lee Lewis put on a Celtics shirt?
I don't remember.
Don't remember. I don't think so.
Didn't you punch somebody's face during that thing and get thrown out, Jerry? What happened?
So I'll tell you what happened. So I was with your brother, Jimmy.
There we go.
And Jimmy and I were in the bathroom taking a piss. And
oh, different time.
It was a different time, but this is hilarious. He goes, watch this. And he starts peeing in the ear into a cup that's like a beer cup right next to us that had beer in it. And it was like his piss was going up in the air and it was coming down right inside the beer cup. And we're laughing. And all of a sudden, this huge dude comes out of the stall. And he's like, that's my fear. And me and him just ran as fast as we could out and got lost in the sea of people.
I love it. I love it. That's awesome. That's a good story. I like that channel story. Oh, my God. I like that channel story. That's hilarious.
That was definitely good. The crowds were big. You could definitely get out there and hide in the middle of, like you said, 1,500 more people.
Yeah. We just ran and split in different directions, and we caught up with each other afterwards. Like, oh God, we missed getting our ass kicked on that one, you know.
But awesome.
But I mean, so his brother Jimmy plays in the band now. Now, a similar funny thing happened one time with a pee story again. We were at the loft on Thayer Street, and we're pissing off the loft on top of a car. Right? So it's not raining out. All of a sudden, the windshield wipers come on the dude's car down below.
Not too happy, I bet. Figure it out.
Three floors up. No big deal.
Hey, good luck.
I have another friend who he went to the channel. He told me, I went to see Nina, 99.
Nina, yeah.
But he goes, but it wasn't that. He was a suburban guy. He goes, it was Nina Hagen. And he's like,
totally different.
A little more than he thought he was going to get. I don't think he's been the same since.
Who's that cackling? Is that Dinky?
That's me. Nancy, my wife, is laughing. But good stories, you guys. Well, we got about 5 or 6 minutes before we have to finish this, but you've got to... Yeah, the stories are getting better and better as you're going on here and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we could probably do another whole episode with you guys. And I hate to like skip over certain things, but there's still so much to talk about. But let's do this. I want to get to the phase two. But before that, I would say, I would say that you guys, the Dogmatics, wrote two of the best, I would say Boston songs, so to speak, of the 1980s. Thayer Street is probably the one most people know, and also It Sure Don't Feel Like Christmas Time, which is just a great song about Boston in that era and what it was like. Peter, I think, did Paul write the lyrics to that one? Was that his song?
Yes.
I did. I can take a credit for it here and there stuff, but he pretty much wrote it.
That's okay. Well, you're probably more aware of it than anybody else. I'm curious, how did that song come about, if you know?
I wrote it, and he really did capture the mood of, the lousiness of Christmas coming when you're not part of it.
right. That's a great song. So again, those two songs to me are like really classic Boston songs, and we'll never grow old hearing them for sure. Let's go down to phase two now, which I'll say. This is so around, again, in the interim, you guys are doing some benefits here and there. Jimmy would step in, Johnny would step in, but 2019 was really when I think you guys decided, okay, we're still, we have some stuff to do here still. So the band essentially reforms, I would say, and then you did a deal with Rumbar Records. Can you kind of tell me how that came up out of nowhere, essentially?
Our kids are all growing up at this point. I'm playing a little bit with Jimmy O'Halloran, in a band with my friend Jed, and I occasionally go out to this place, the Plow and Star, on Sundays to see the Mess Around, which is Jay Allen's monthly kind of people doing songs out of their
range
comfort zone, so. Anyways, it was kind of a cool thing. And while I was there one time, Jay he said, why don't you guys do some songs for Lou Mansoff? He's the rum guard guy. He loves you guys. And me, Peter, and Jimmy went and met with Lou at Foley's on Kingston Street downtown. And talked about doing a record. You remember that, Pete? You think you were very sick that night, right?
I was. And in fact, I took your medical advice, which is very good, and I had a nice couple of whiskeys, and I felt great.
That's right.
So
I did, yeah, that's exactly what we did.
You should be a doctor.
I know I should be a doctor. I think we had like four Jamesons each, and you were like, oh, I feel great now. And so we kind of did the deal. We did the deal there, kind of, and, you know, he was like, you know, said, hey, listen, I'd love to put out your stuff, and so we started practicing and writing songs, and it slowly came together, and it's, you know, you're always surprised that you still have something left in the tank, you know?
Yeah,
and it was literally your first new material, like, you know, more than 30 years, right? So you guys put out the EP, She's the One, which sounded like, you know, Dogmatics, but it sounded more modern, more current, I guess, if that makes any sense. But it sounded for you, like you guys, for sure.
Yeah. So I had to side doing some more like folky type stuff as
that's right.
Hired Man.
Yeah.
And I've been playing with James Young, and he's mandolin guy, and he's a very talented dude, and you know, overflowing with creativity, got a great voice and stuff. So it was only natural that he became part of Dogmatics over time. And so now I'm out of business as a vocalist. So it's very good.
So
he pumps up vocals, and he's a very creative guy. And, you know, songwriter.
And I mean, honestly, and he played with us probably 4 or 5 years, where, you know, I think even Tommy said, is he in the band, or what's he doing? And I'm like, I guess he's in the band. And he keeps coming to practice. And now the thing about that, when you think about all that stuff, so, okay, we have a place to rehearse, which, you know, that's a big thing. We have a place to rehearse. And then I became good friends with this guy, Ed Reamer, who owns a studio in my hometown. And then he almost, like, I wouldn't say a member, but he's become like part of our family. And everything has become easy. It's not incredibly difficult to do it.
Right.
You know, the hardest thing maybe is just driving to the rehearsal space and, you know, committing to that time. And, you know, we all have more time now, maybe some more than others, but we do have more time and we can focus a little bit.
Yeah. And it's better on time. It. Didn't you say, like, just pre-COVID, when we were talking about making more music, you go, let's do another album. We don't have much more time left after all, you know?
I did say that. I know. It is true. But, you never know. You never know.
And if you think about it, we have less now, so.
We're live right now. We don't know tomorrow what's going to bring. We don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, you just got to keep on keeping on and do it.
To your point, though, too, Jerry, it's like back then in the, you know, 80s, you guys, everybody's trying to get a record deal, trying to become famous, you know, trying to do it, you know, going on tours, you know, living, sleeping on floors. At this point in your lives, that's not the dream. Right now, it's just like, get together with your friends, have some, you know, have a good times, play some shows, play some new music, hang out with the people that come to you. I mean, it's just a whole different mindset, too, now, right? It's all positive.
It is true, but if, you know, some big band came along and said, hey, listen, we're going to pay you a shit ton of money, and we're going to put you up in hotels, and you don't have to bring any gear, yeah, we'll do that. No problem.
Of course.
Bring it on. But we're happy what we're doing right here in our hometown, so.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's awesome.
How much time do we have left, Dan? Can we have time for a few more or wrap up soon?
Yeah, go for a few more real quick.
All right, I will. So you tell me to stop, we'll do this. If not, we'll have another episode down the road here. So new record comes out, and then, like I said, Lou's a big fan. He released all your older stuff, which sounds great. Again, reissued. 2022, you dropped another song, Drop That Needle, which is an awesome single. I was like, really, like, holy crap. It was like one of the best songs of the year, I thought. It came out, and it paid homage to some of your longtime friends and other bands in the area. And then you guys started playing some pretty big shows in the area at that point. I mean, before I get ahead to that, the documentary came out, we talked about earlier, Rudy's documentary, in 2023. So maybe give us a little bit of background how that came together with how you guys connected with Rudy or he connected with you guys.
Okay. So back in the old days, I had some friends, and they were friends with Rudy. They lived in Rockland, Mass., and I met him over the summer, being teenagers and all that stuff.
Yep.
He lived down in Maryland. And he was kind of on the forefront of, he was doing a lot of photography and all that stuff. Like he'd just go with his camera. And he's a big dude. He looked like Sasquatch when he's 15, you know. And he'd go to every single show available and take all kinds of pictures and all that stuff. So early on, he did that. And when we played
video
in 85, did we play at the 930 Club? And
yeah,
he was. Yeah. It was nearby, and he came and he videoed it with VHS. So. Cutting edge back then, you know.
Yeah.
So the footage survives, and so it's only natural that he became a documentary filmmaker. And by the way, that's not his first documentary. He, at that same time, he was managing a heavy metal band, and he did a documentary about that, which is very interesting stuff.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I'm sure you can find it if you go through the, you know, the proper.
Yeah, I'll look into it for sure.
It's going to be, the documentary link is going to be on bostonsbestliverock.com in the video section for the channel, and which is the channel's website that we have. And what you're going to do is you'll be on the top list, because that's a real nice documentary done well, and it shows Boston in the time that we're talking of in the 80s.
Rudy took some incredible footage. There's also other footage that kind of came up in the archives from your former like publicist. We did artwork over the years. I mean, some really incredible like archival, the music, the videos. I mean, footage from the loft. Really, some incredible, really incredible stuff from back in that day. Which, you know, most bands don't have that.
Exactly.
You know, because, like you said,
exactly.
Peter, it was very unusual to have someone with a VHS going around, or you know, a recorder. There were literally like, you know, Instamatic snap cameras back then. That was about it. No one had phones or anything like that. So none of these shows really documented that well. But the footage that you guys were able to gather, that Rudy gathered for this movie, are incredible. So it's really a step back in time. I highly recommend people check out the documentary on, again, documentary. They were Boston's house band. They will be attached to this episode, like Dinky just said. I know it went from awards and film shows, and now it's on YouTube. It's on Roku, Tubi. So I'd highly recommend that for sure, though. It's excellent.
In fact, it's probably going to be up on Boston's Best Live Rock today or tomorrow, because the lady that does that, she's getting ready to put the link up. She's flipping out over it. I'm saying, wow, this is well done, you know? And it really is, for a documentary about a band and about individuals and about the music and about everything. I think this gentleman's done a real good job, a real good job. And
he'll be glad. I'll tell him that. He'll be glad to hear that. Yep.
If he wants
100%, it's great.
If he wants to do another, it can do me. No. All I know is the way he's done it with all the documentation from that time, as well as his own stuff. And laid it out. He's laid it out with the music correctly, and how it should be for artists like yourselves, you know. And I really got off on it. I haven't watched it all, but I watched a good portion of it, and I'm saying this tells a wonderful story about a wonderful band that came out of the channel. Actually, that came out.
It really does.
Came out of that era, but not just the channel. The Rat, Bunraddy's, yep. All those places that you played. Whether you played the channel 1 minute and then an hour later you're playing the Rat. It's fine because, you know, wonderful stuff. Because that scene was just where it was at, and you guys had a real good time doing that scene. And Sean is the last one in that whole era that does the scene the way it should be. That's with all the bands he's had around him and stuff and promoting, and his Sam Black Church and all that stuff. Anyway,
I just appreciate the talent these guys have had, and it's just great to see a band from that era that's still doing it, really. And
exactly.
I think we might want to do a second episode, guys. We could talk offline later on, but there's still a lot of stuff I want to get into, because I don't think it's
We're going to have to close off now. But the thing is we have to talk about the Matweeds on that second one, Jerry's Other Band. And see,
yeah, definitely. And again, let me just real quick. I know you guys have played a bunch of big shows in the past 5 or 6, 8 years. And then I think, yeah, let's try and get a second episode at some point soon, guys, because I think there's more to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool.
All right, you guys. Yeah. We're going to, it's three, so we have to call it at this time. But I just want to thank you guys. And yes, we'll do this again, Sean, with these guys, because you got some good stuff going on. And that's very important.
Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome. This is Two Pints in a Corner with the Dogmatics. Closing out.
Five
now. Okay, yeah, we're done. We'll do it next time for sure. Sean's got a whole bunch of questions as long as his arm, I'll tell you. He's got them all wrote down and stuff. But he loves
it. Yeah, this was good, guys. I really appreciate it. I feel like we go off here and there, but there's still so much more to talk about. So if you guys do have, if it's next Wednesday, awesome. If it's you want to give it a little time. But it would be nice if you guys had the time next Wednesday. We could try and do these episodes back-to-back. That way they would come out back-to-back.
Good point, Sean. Good point.
This will be published probably next Thursday or Friday, I'm thinking. Is that right?
I would say next Thursday, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you guys have time next Wednesday, we could, if you want to get back to me later on, that's fine. But I think that'd be really great to have a second episode if you guys are up for it.
And that'll be the following Thursday. That would be,
Yeah, we'll figure it out afterwards. Binky, just wanted to, just before I get off here, I have one of my friend Ed Reema, the guy I told you about, the studio. Anyways, he's working at my house downstairs right now. He's doing some work for me. And Dave Minahan just stopped by to drop off some stuff for him. And he just wanted me to reach out to say hi to you. He remembers you and he hopes everything's going well for you.
We have to do that, Sean. Dave's.
Yeah, David's on our list. I got the neighbor has played the channel with anybody, so Dave is definitely on one of my next to call people after I get you guys on your second episode for sure.
Yeah.
So
you want to talk about a wise ass man? Ooh. David's right up there.
But the thing is, very creative wise ass. That's a wise ass. You guys are the same. I mean, what you've gone through and with all this scene. It's fantastic. I mean, and you keep in Boston. Boston is your home. Whether you live out a little bit further, it's still Boston is your home, and I love it. And and $75 won't get you a drink these days. But
yeah, I know. Won't get you.
But
it'll get you two pints in the corner with Dinky.
That's it. Two pints in the corner. Close it out again.
Perfect.
Okay, thank you, guys. We'll see if we can do it next week and do that. Yeah, and
all right, cool.
We're going to go after Dave Minney on that at this point right now, because he's another one that we definitely love to have on this.
Yeah,